Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Voiko vanhemmuuteen valmistautua? Mikä vauvakuplassa on totta ja mikä ei? Liberon odotushuone-podcastissa tehdään todellinen syväsukellus vanhemmuuden tiekarttaan. Minä olen Marja Hintikka ja tämä vanhemmuuden odotushuoneen ovi on aina auki, just sulle.
Hi, I'm Una Chaplin and I'm the host of Hollywood Exiles. It tells the story of how my grandfather Charlie Chaplin and many others were caught up in a campaign to root out communism in Hollywood. Hollywood Exiles from CBC Podcasts and the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 18th of April, these are our main stories. The Republican leader of the House of Representatives names a day for a vote on giving more aid to Ukraine. Republican Senator Rich McCormick says the fate of the country is crucial, partly because of the grain it grows.
If Russia controls that 70% of Europe's grain, it would be very disruptive to our future.
Qatar says it's re-evaluating its role mediating between Israel and Hamas more than 6 months into the devastating conflict in Gaza.
There are limits to the ability to which we can contribute to these negotiations in a constructive manner.
The safety of Boeing's 787 Dreamliner planes is under scrutiny at hearings in the US Congress, as a whistleblower says the aircraft could break apart mid-air. Also in this podcast, a severe drought leads to power cuts in Ecuador and a political reckoning there. And 200 million years after becoming extinct, a fossil discovered in southwest England sheds new light on a gigantic marine reptile.
So we know that these ichthyosaurs become truly gigantic right up until their extinction.
President Zelensky has constantly told the West that many deaths and casualties on and off the battlefield in Ukraine's war against Russia could be avoided if allies, especially America, gave more military aid. He's been waiting months for a $61 billion aid package from the US, which has been blocked by some Republicans in Congress. Now Mike Johnson, the Republican leader of the House of Representatives, says there'll be a vote on Saturday. Republican Congressman for Georgia, Rich McCormick, says Ukraine is on the front line of preserving security, and not only in Europe.
Strategically, Ukraine is much more important than most people realize. It's a top five country in resources. It's got a ton of European grain. Obviously, about 70% of European grain comes from. If Russia controls that 70% of Europe's grain, into the future, they'll be selling it to Iran and China and North Korea instead of European countries or friendly countries. It would be very disruptive to our future.
A North America correspondent, David Willis, told me more about the significance of Saturday's vote.
It follows weeks of delay during which the situation, of course, in Ukraine, but also in Gaza, has grown increasingly desperate. And in an attempt to appease some right-wing members of his party who've been feuding over this, the House Speaker, Mike Johnson, who's a Republican, has split this $95 billion aid package into a number of separate funding bills, one of which would provide another $61 billion in military aid for Ukraine. Another would provide a further $26 billion in aid for Israel, including funding for humanitarian assistance for Gaza, and another which would provide $8 billion in aid for Taiwan. And in order to sweeten the deal, if you like, with his party members, Mike Johnson has also brought forward measures that would tighten security along America's southern border with Mexico.
Are many people against him on this issue?
Well, Mike Johnson has declined up to now to bring a Ukraine aid bill, Val, to the floor of the House for fear of igniting the sort of rebellion amongst right-wingers in his party that still threatens to cost him his job. Those right-wing lawmakers are leery about indefinite support for Ukraine, and they believe that any such aid should be tied to tighter security measures along the US southern border. And now, less than 6 months after he took over from Kevin McCarthy, who of course was the first House Speaker in US history to be ousted from the position, Mike Johnson's role is very much in jeopardy, with hardliners, among them the Georgia representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, calling for him to be removed at a time when resignations have shrunk the Republican Party's majority in the lower chamber to just one vote. And that has left Mike Johnson unable to govern the lower chamber without the support of the Democrats. And his ousting could throw the House of Representatives into absolute chaos, of course, when Congress is dealing with a number of global crises all at the same time.
David Willis. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has insisted his country will make its own decisions about how to respond to Iran's drone and missile attack at the weekend. He was speaking after meeting the British and German foreign ministers, who both called for restraint. There are fears that retaliation by Israel could trigger a regional war in the Middle East. Our diplomatic correspondent James Landale reports from Jerusalem.
Lord Cameron came to Israel as part of an unofficial diplomatic double act with his German counterpart, Annalena Baerbock. They met the same leaders, sometimes together, sometimes separately, but always with the same message. Israel must act in a way to limit, not expand, this conflict. There was an acceptance that Israel would retaliate against Iran for the missile attack, but it was still worth urging caution. After his meeting with Benjamin Netanyahu, the Foreign Secretary said he wanted to show solidarity with Israel, but
we don't want to see escalation. We hope that anything Israel does is as limited as possible.
Lord Cameron also raised the situation in Gaza, where the humanitarian crisis is still dire, urging Israel to get more aid in, even though there were, he said, encouraging signs. He also appealed to Hamas to release Israeli hostages and accept what he called a good ceasefire deal. Annalena Baerbock called for prudent restraint and said that escalation would serve no one, including Israel's security. At a cabinet meeting later, Mr. Netanyahu thanked both ministers for their support in the defence of Israel, but seemed less keen on their counsel.
They also have all kinds of suggestions and advice. I appreciate it. But I want to make it clear, we will make our own decisions, and the State of Israel will do everything necessary to defend itself.
Despite this, Israel's government and its Western allies do seem united in wanting to maintain the diplomatic support for Israel that emerged in the wake of Iran's attack.
James Landale. Meanwhile, Qatar has warned that it is, in its words, re-evaluating its role as a mediator between Israel and Hamas. Its Prime Minister, Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdulrahman Al Thani, made the comment at a news conference in Doha.
We are committed to our role from a humanitarian standpoint, but there are limits to the ability to which we can contribute to these negotiations in a constructive manner. And the State of Qatar will take the appropriate decision at the appropriate time.
Any Qatari decision to abandon its role as a mediator could have serious consequences for the currently deadlocked attempts to negotiate a way out of the impasse in Gaza. With more details, here's our correspondent, Wira Davis.
Thus far, Qatar has played a pivotal role, along with Egypt and America, in trying to secure a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas, which would see the release of hostages taken by Hamas in exchange for Palestinians held in Israeli jails. It's been a delicate, largely unsuccessful process, but the links that Qatar has with all sides, including close ties to Hamas, are regarded as crucial to achieving any breakthrough. Qatar is now openly questioning chances of those talks succeeding and says it's re-evaluating its role as a mediator. Some critical voices from within the US Congress have criticised Qatar for not putting enough pressure on Hamas to make concessions.
Wira Davis. US senators have been scrutinising Boeing's safety record as the aeroplane maker attempts to reassure its customers and investors that they can have confidence in the company. Boeing has been in crisis since January after a panel on one of its 737 MAX planes blew out during a flight. No one was injured. Sam Salipour, an engineer and whistleblower at Boeing, has been giving evidence to senators about the 787 Dreamliner.
I have analyzed Boeing's own data to conclude that the company is taking manufacturing shortcuts on the 787 program that may significantly reduce the airplane safety and the life cycle. Since 2013, there have been serious issues on the 787 program, not properly closing thousands of gaps in its assembly of the fuselage on major joints. Effectively, they are putting out defective airplanes.
But Boeing has dismissed these claims as unfounded, saying the 787 has safely taken more than 4 million flights and has met the approval of US regulators. Our North America business correspondent Michelle Fleury told me more about the Senate hearings in Washington.
This is very much about Boeing's safety culture being under the spotlight after a number of incidents, including most recently the Alaska Airlines plane where a door flew off the side. And today we heard from whistleblowers, and it wasn't just one, there were several of them, which made it all the more powerful, giving their accounts. One of them you just referred to was Sam Salipour. He is a Boeing engineer turned whistleblower who said that they were putting out defective planes and expressed his concerns about the 787 Dreamliner planes, that there were shortcuts being taken to try and deal with production bottlenecks. And that's what made him raise concerns that the planes could fall out of the air. In response, he said he had faced retaliation and harassment. We also heard from another whistleblower, Ed Pearson, who talked about this being a criminal cover-up and said that Boeing had illegally stopped conducting quality control inspections. Boeing has said it takes safety very seriously, that there is nothing wrong with its jets, but clearly the spotlight was on them today. And we heard on one of the committees them saying that the CEO, David Calhoun, would be expected to testify certainly in the future.
And what could the impact of these hearings be, do you think? Because it's strong stuff, isn't it?
It is. I mean, there's a couple of things to remember here. There are only two major plane makers in the world. Boeing is one of them, Airbus is the other, and they have full order books. So if you're an airplane maker right now, you don't really have much choice in terms of where you can go to get more planes. But Boeing is an American industrial icon, and its reputation right now is severely damaged. What we're seeing is lawmakers essentially doing their jobs, holding them to account, and this could pose risk to defense contracts down the line and lead to more stringent government oversight.
Michelle Fleury. Now, when you think of huge dinosaurs, you may conjure up images of magnificent and sometimes terrifying creatures that once roamed the earth. But there were some equally impressive sea creatures too, including one called the ichthyosaur, which looked a bit like a cross between a dolphin and a whale. Now, 200 million years after they became extinct, a fossil of a jawbone measuring more than 2 metres has been found on the coast of southwest England. Scientists believe, based on the size of the jawbone, the whole animal was 25 metres long. That's bigger than previously thought. Our science reporter, Jordina Ranard, told me more about this discovery.
We're actually talking about two different groups of fossils which were found by these amateur fossil hunters in the UK. They found them when they were digging around in the mud on the beach. And they're fossilised jawbones. I saw the pieces earlier today. They were found over a number of years. And now scientists have analysed the specimens and they've concluded they were from this marine reptile, the gigantic ichthyosaur. And when you compare those jawbones to other marine reptiles that were maybe the size of orcas or dolphins that we might know, it's absolutely massive. And scientists use that to estimate just how big its body was. And to find out more about this, I was speaking to a paleontologist, Dean Lomax, at the University of Bristol.
This discovery is hugely important because not only do we now have two of these giant jawbones, we could now work out that they belong to this ancient giant ichthyosaur that we've called Ichthyotitan Sevenensis. This animal lived about 202 million years ago, right before this major extinction event that wiped out this group of animals. So we know that these ichthyosaurs become truly gigantic right up until their extinction.
Georgina, briefly, you've been speaking to the fossil finders. Do they think they're going to find more?
Well, they hope so, and partly because that would actually help them narrow down just how big it was. They think it's the largest ever, but what they really want is a complete skull or skeleton. They told me it is really rare to find these things, but anyone can do it, and this discovery is testimony to the power of these amateur fossil hunters who spend all their time digging around in the mud on beaches or in quarries and manage to find these types of amazing fossils.
Georgina Reynard. The British actor Hugh Grant says he's reluctantly settled a lawsuit against the publisher of The Sun newspaper. The film star had accused the paper of unlawful gathering of information, and his case was being heard with other high-profile claimants, including Prince Harry. Nikki Schiller reports.
Hugh Grant was suing newsgroup newspapers, the publishers of The Sun, claiming journalists had used private investigators to tap his phone and burgle his house. It had been expected he would have his time in court in January next year, but now he's unexpectedly settled out of court. The actor, best known for films such as Notting Hill, Four Weddings and a Funeral, and Love Actually, said he did not want to accept what he called the enormous sum of money he'd been offered, but that continuing to fight the case risked making him liable for substantial legal costs approaching $12.5 million, even if he won. Newsgroup Newspapers has always denied the claims and said the undisclosed settlement with Mr. Grant was reached without admission of liability, as it was in both parties' financial interests not to progress to a costly trial. The legal commentator Joshua Rosenberg says it's hard to predict how much a case will cost.
If you have unlimited funds, and which of us has, clearly not even Hugh Grant, well, then you can afford to take on a corporation. That's the sort of thing Prince Harry has done. But most of us can't afford the risk, particularly if the other side is going to rack up costs.
Newsgroup Newspapers has rejected allegations of any wrongdoing by staff at The Sun and has settled hundreds of cases without making any admission of liability. Rupert Murdoch's UK publishing companies, which included the now-defunct News of the World, are reported to have paid out more than $1.2 billion in settlements and legal fees. Hugh Grant, who has been a prominent campaigner on press reform, says he will use his settlement money to boost groups such as Hacked Off, which campaigns for a free and accountable press.
Nikki Schiller. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
Truman.
Tell me everything. Go back. We're talking the governor's wildebeest wife, that fat-ankled Harry.
Yes! Get out there!
American author Truman Capote's relationships with high society female friends is featured in a new Disney drama. We hear from the actor in the lead role. It's been a year since conflict in Sudan broke out, leaving around 8 million people internally displaced and causing at least another 2 million to flee the country. Along with the violence, the great danger is food insecurity. And with farming disrupted, there's a real potential for that to lead to famine on a mass scale. Michael Dunford is the World Food Programme's Regional Director for Eastern Africa, and he described the scale of the problem to Rebecca Kesby.
So the situation in Sudan today is a catastrophe. Our fear is going to continue to deteriorate. There are 18 million people who are acutely hungry, 5 million of those in emergency levels of hunger. So the World Food Programme and others are desperately trying to scale our operations to meet the needs. But because of the insecurity, because of the complexity of the environment, we are simply not reaching all of the people who need our support. We need to have a ceasefire. We need to be able to reach the populations where they are. You've mentioned already 8 million people who are internally displaced inside Sudan. There's another 2 million who have crossed international borders into places like Chad and South Sudan. So it's a combination of factors.
I don't know whether it's been possible for your teams on the ground to work in any way with the two warring factions and what the risks of that might be in terms of the aid, but also whether that might help and whether they'd be interested in helping to distribute aid to civilians.
This is something that often is lost. There are so many stakeholders, so many actors in this conflict. When we try and organise convoys, we have to negotiate each and every time we move into new territories controlled by different actors. This slows down the process enormously. We did a convoy recently from Port Sudan into northern Darfur. It took us over 3 weeks because of the number of times we needed to stop and negotiate.
The World Food Programme is involved in many different areas in the world, and a staggering 160 million people have been receiving aid from your organisation in the past couple of years. Is that sustainable?
At the moment, it probably is not. The needs, particularly post-COVID, but now because of the various conflicts, and it's not just Sudan, but it's Gaza, it's Ukraine, it's Yemen and others, we're having to prioritise who we do support, who we don't support. I'm very concerned about what the future holds, because in Sudan and many of these other countries, the situation is deteriorating. We are seeing increased levels of malnutrition, and ultimately we will see even more severe outcomes unless WFP and others are able to meet those needs.
Michael Dunford from the World Food Programme speaking to Rebecca Kesby. A severe drought has led to power cuts in Ecuador, which relies on hydroelectric sources for much of its electricity. The capital, Quito, and other major cities have already suffered hours without power. Now the crisis has sparked a political reckoning, with the president overruling and then replacing his energy minister. I got more from our Latin America online reporter, Vanessa Buschlitter.
So Ecuador, as well as neighbouring Colombia, have been experiencing a severe drought, which has been linked to the El Niño weather phenomenon. So there has been a lack of rain, and both countries get most of their energy from hydroelectric power. And you need a certain water level to work those hydroelectric power plants. So when those water levels drop, those plants don't work, you don't get energy, and then you have to think about rationing energy, which is what Ecuador decided to do. And there have been power cuts in some of the major cities for up to 5 or 6 hours in a country which has seen security really plummet. So you can imagine how worried people were when the power went out in these large cities.
And this has led to a political reckoning, hasn't it?
It has, because the way this came about was a little bit chaotic. On Friday, the energy minister insisted that there wouldn't be a rationing of energy, that there wouldn't be power cuts. Speed forward to the weekend, and suddenly people were left without power, without any warning. And so on Monday, the energy ministry had to do an about-face and say that they were going to ration energy, but they said they would adhere to a schedule, so to allow people to prepare for the power cuts, which of course is very important because businesses need to prepare. Say, for example, you've got a food business. You want to know beforehand when you will not have power so that you can prepare food. And they announced this, but then the president came out and retracted that and said there would not be power cuts in this week. So Ecuadorians have been giving these conflicting bits of information, and you can understand why they would be pretty fed up.
And also, I suppose the question is, how does the president know that they won't be necessary, the power cuts?
Exactly. And the energy companies seem to have ploughed ahead with further rationing because there's a shortage and there's no other way to combat that shortage. So until it rains, there's very little that these energy companies can do. The situation in Ecuador has been further exacerbated by the fact that normally Ecuador imports power from neighbouring Colombia. But because Colombia has also got a drought and is experiencing the same problems, they've said they will prioritise their own consumers and will stop temporarily exporting their power to Ecuador.
Vanessa Buschlitter. The authorities in the United Arab Emirates have denied reports that widespread floods in the country are the result of a weather modification process known as cloud seeding. More than a year's worth of rain fell in just 24 hours. Thousands of passengers are stranded at Dubai International Airport after their flights were cancelled or delayed. Graham Satchell has been following the story.
The storm in Dubai and across the whole region was extraordinary. It left cars submerged and abandoned, planes taxiing through flooded runways, and emergency services in boats here rescuing a cat clinging to a car door for dear life. The United Arab Emirates is one of the driest regions in the world, so how could so much rain fall in such an arid area? For more than 20 years, the UAE has been using a process called cloud seeding teams of pilots fly into the clouds and spray salt particles to encourage more water to form. The UAE flies more than 300 missions a year. Is cloud seeding to blame for worsening the floods? Professor Martin Ambaum, a meteorologist at the University of Reading, is sceptical.
It has nothing to do with this particular weather event. It was very well predicted several days in advance. The National Meteorological Center in the Emirates will not have gone out to do seeding in that particular system. And even if they had, the scale of this weather system was so large that cloud seeding operations would not have had any effect on it.
Meteorologists say climate change is likely to be the main reason for the severity of the storm, but the cause of the excessive flooding may be more banal. Dubai is a city of concrete and glass. It's expanded rapidly in the last few decades and has little infrastructure like storm drains that could help it deal with a sudden influx of water. So while the finger of blame is being pointed by some at what may appear to be slightly scary sci-fi technology, poor town planning may be the more prosaic reason the streets of Dubai are still flooded.
Graham Satchell. From his chilling true crime book, In Cold Blood, to his novella, Breakfast at Tiffany's, the American author Truman Capote has been celebrated for his writing style. He was obsessed with high society, and his depiction of his wealthy female friends and the scandalous revelations of their closest kept secrets are at the heart of a new Disney Plus TV drama called Feud, Capote versus the Swans.
Truman,
tell me everything.
Here's the fact. Even your sister will steal your man. I don't know what matters more to him, the sex or you knowing about it.
Wait, go back. We're talking the governor's wildebeest wife, that fat ankled Harrigan.
Yes!
Only you can show us these women, Truman. How they really are. You're looking.
Well, the man who plays Truman Capote is the British actor Tom Hollander from hits like The Night Manager and The White Lotus. He spoke to Martha Carney.
It's definitely the part of a lifetime. I did love playing it. He's a very complex and very brilliant character, and he's tragic, and there's a descending arc in which he destroys himself, all the things that actors love to play. So it was a big moment for me to get that part.
And as you said, tragic time in his life because he'd had all this literary success, but he was plagued by many problems and he found himself in the midst of high society, but it wasn't really his world, was it? It wasn't where he grew up.
No, it wasn't where he grew up. He was abandoned by his mother when he was about four and she tried to enter high society herself, leaving him with an aunt in Monroeville, Alabama. And he sort of caught up with her about the age of 10 and was quite interested in high society from a very early age himself. He formed relationships with Una Chaplin and people like that when he was very young. So he always had the same aspiration himself, which came to a climax with his black and white ball in 1966. Which we dramatise in the show. His mother's progress had ended up tragically. She'd nearly made it in the Upper East Side, and then Joe Capote, her husband, turned out to be a sort of fraud, and she killed herself. And in our show, the black and white ball is dramatised as Truman's revenge on behalf of his mother. It's his gift to her. Mum, you didn't make it, but I did. Look at me now. It's that. He wrote a satire about a bunch of ladies in a restaurant. They were thinly veiled versions of his real-life friends. And it was quite obvious, certainly within their circle, who he was talking about. And he satirised them rather brutally. He didn't draw them with the compassion that he drew his more famous characters, Holly Golightly or Dick and Perry in Cold Blood. It's rather cruel. And they were very hurt and they sort of cancelled him and ostracised him. And so he lost this connection to these fancy people that meant so much to him. He was an addictive personality and addicted to booze, but also addicted to sort of fancy people, I think. And he should have been, you know, at his desk writing great literature. Anyway, when they cancelled him, Ryan Murphy, Gus Van Sant, John Robbie Bates, just to give the creative people some credit, in their version, he goes on a slow descent to self-destruction and gives in to booze and drugs and all the rest of it, and died aged 59.
The actor, Tom Hollander. Since the dawn of recorded music, artists have incorporated the sounds of nature into their songs. Think of the chirping wildlife in the Beatles' Blackbird, or the outdoor acoustics of Neil Young's Natural Beauty. Now, from Thursday, artists who illustrate their work with nature will be able to automatically split their profits with environmental causes through a project called Sounds Right, which is supported by the UN. Our music correspondent Mark Savage has been speaking to two of the artists taking part, Roxy Music co-founder Brian Eno and the Norwegian pop artist Aurora.
I'm scared to touch, to test, to be undone.
It's an unusual duet.
I walk the streets.
David Bowie singing with wild pigs, bees and hyenas.
Against the voice of doom.
His co-writer Brian Eno has remixed the track as part of an environmental campaign.
I feel I should get real.
This project is a way of saying to artists, look, we all use the sounds of nature a lot in what we do. Seagulls and waves and wind, and why don't we pay nature a royalty for that? Then redirect that money towards people who are helping save the world, actually save the planet.
Backed by the United Nations, the project will also see ambient sounds from the rainforest and the ocean monetized on streaming services. But music is the key.
What I think music can do is to give you feelings. And if you can say to people, can you imagine a better world? Here's what it would sound like. That gives people a set of feelings about how life could be, how else things could be.
Artists who have contributed to the first wave of releases include Ellie Goulding and the Norwegian pop star Aurora, who's mixed the sound of her homeland's forests into the song A Soul With No King.
The beautiful thing about art and artists is that we do manage to speak to people in a way that doesn't feel like being preached to and has a very good chance of making contact with nature seem desirable again. Like a mother
and a home. The project could easily be dismissed as a gimmick. But Brian Eno, who, after all, pioneered ambient music, says turning to nature gives him new colours to paint with.
It's such a thrill working with natural sounds. They're wild elements. And you have to make a decision about whether you are going to try to make them sound more like instruments or whether you're going to let them be what they are and to pull the music somewhere else.
Yes, on the David Bowie track that you've remixed, Get Real, it sounds like the hyenas and the wild pigs that are in there are almost musical collaborators. They're responding to the energy of the music.
Yes, they sound quite angry, don't they, sometimes?
Yes. Do you think music has the power to change?
The strength in music is that it's easier for people to agree on because it's wrapped in beauty, and no change will ever happen unless people stand together.
Most politics and most media gain their energy from finding things that separate people, and social media particularly is this. It's very important that there should be ways that we can communicate that make us feel that it's worth cooperating rather than fighting. What gives me hope is we're having conversations like this, and lots of people are having conversations like this.
It gives me a lot of hope to see that for the kids, a conversation around the environment is so obvious. They're already strongly opinionated.
And the last thing I'll say that really encourages me is that old people like me are dying. The people who run the fossil fuel companies, the people who pay advertising companies to tell lies about what is really happening now. I don't think they have a platform in the future. So here's to death.
Let's make a new world together, Brian.
I was hoping you'd ask.
Brian Eno and Aurora ending that report by Mark Savage. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. This edition was mixed by Alicia Thursting. The producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.
Voiko vanhemmuuteen valmistautua? Mikä vauvakuplassa on totta ja mikä ei? Liberon odotushuone-podcastissa tehdään todellinen syväsukellus vanhemmuuden tiekarttaan. Minä olen Marja Hintikka ja tämä vanhemmuuden odotushuoneen ovi on aina auki, just sulle.